And this show is Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. And we have a concert to talk about at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. It's the Easton Symphony Orchestra combined with the East Central Illinois Youth Orchestra Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Dowden Fine Arts Center in Charleston. We'll be talking with conductor Richard Rossi in the first part of our show. And then later, it's Dr. Patrick Warfield, who is one of the country's leading scholars of John Philip Sousa. He's going to be on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana Sunday to give a guest lecture at 1 in the afternoon. It's called The Essence of Uncle Sam, John Philip Sousa's 1911 World Tour. And that should be an interesting conversation as well. Hope you'll stay with us on Live and Local. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. We just heard a little music from Mozart's fourth violin concerto, which will be among the featured works on a concert this Sunday late afternoon by the Eastern Symphony Orchestra at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. Anna Cromwell is a violin professor there and will be the soloist for that. And there are a couple of other faculty soloists and a student soloist and a youth orchestra joining the sort of extravaganza going on there Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Dowden Fine Arts Center. Richard Rossi is conductor and music director of the Eastern Symphony Orchestra and is with me on the phone from Charleston right now. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So, extravaganza, lots of solo performers going on for this particular concert, and one of those special concert performance in memory of a former faculty member of yours.
Right, David Hobbs. He was on piano faculty here. Matter of fact, he passed away, it's been like 3 years now, still can't believe it. But believe it or not, David was supposed to play the Paganini with me, at least the 18th variation. We had wanted to do it, and we were going to plan it, and then he became ill. And he came down with cancer. So we never were able to do it. And then Derek Manafort, who is one of our junior performance majors, who won the Tchaikovsky, played Tchaikovsky in the concerto competition 2 years ago as a freshman and won, I thought it was a perfect piece for him to play with the orchestra in memory of David. And I really have been wanting to do the Rhapsody on the theme of Paganini for several years now. And Susan Teicher and I spoke about it and thought, you know, this would be a great opportunity for Derek. And Derek also studied with David Hobbs one summer as well. So it's going to be a nice commemoration to David's memory, especially in light of the fact that he wasn't able to play it with us. So Susan's, matter of fact, going to come out and speak a little bit on David's behalf prior to playing the Rhapsody.
Susan is Derek Manafort's teacher?
Yeah, Susan Teicher is Derek's piano teacher, yes.
Is this a piece that you've ever played as a pianist, out of curiosity?
No, I didn't. Matter of fact, well, it's the piece, believe it or not, I've always wanted to conduct, believe it or not. And it was my first classical album, LP, yes, LP, for those who are out there who still have them. When I was growing up, my brother bought it for me for my birthday, and it had the Rock 2 on it with Leonard Panario and Paganini variations on the other side, and I used to play it all day and thinking, wow, this is the greatest piece. But the interesting thing that you, since you did say, have I played it, the 18th variation was a turning point in my life as well. When I was in junior high, I don't know if you know, I was a late piano, I started piano late. My mother always knew I had it, but we had moved from Long Island to Virginia and blah, blah, blah. She wanted to make sure I had the right teacher, so I was on the waiting list for 2 years, and I didn't even start piano until I was 11. But by the time I got to junior high, I would spend my lunch periods practicing in a little practice room in the band office. And my teacher, I remember in junior high, Mr. Forbes, came to me. He says, how would you like to play something with the band? I went, oh, my gosh, I would love it. And so he gave me, believe it or not, the 18th variation, I guess, arranged for piano and band. And I called my dad right away, and he was excited. He goes, I know exactly what that is, and I'll pick up a recording for you. And I literally went home that night and learned it overnight and came in and told my teacher, I learned it. He goes, are you sure? It's in D-flat major. You learned that whole thing. And so for me, it's very special as well.
Is this the Nimrod variation?
No, the Paganini, the Rhapsody on a Theme, number 18. You know, the da-dee-da-da-da.
Yeah, right.
Right, so I played that when I was in junior high. As a matter of fact, that was a turning point for me, and that's when I realized this is my love, piano.
Oh, I'm mixing up with the Elgar?
The Elgar, right.
Enigma, was the one that's called Nimrod.
Right,
but
Enigma.
Yeah, no, this is the 18th is the famous, particularly famous one from the...
For the Rachmaninoff, right.
Yeah. I'm getting my pieces mixed up.
Oh, that's
up.
Okay.
Yeah, well, so you're finally getting to conduct it.
Yes, and I did the Rock too a couple of years ago when we opened up the building with my good friend Jeff Brown from Western, and I've been waiting to do the Paganini, and I thought, you know, I'm going on sabbatical in the spring, and I thought, well, this is a way to go out. Let's do some of these pieces I've been wanting to do, and we had Derek, who is doing a fabulous job with it, and he's from Mattoon.
Well, here is that famous variation, the 18th variation from Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. You can hear the complete work played by junior pianist Derek Manenfior with the Eastern Symphony Orchestra Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Downa Fine Arts Center in Charleston. Richard Rossi conducting, and Richard's my guest on this portion of Live and Local. That was some of the heart-rendingly beautiful 18th variation from Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini here on Live and Local. And that entire work's going to be on the second half of Sunday afternoon's concert by the Eastern Symphony Orchestra at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. Student performer Derek Manenfior will be the soloist. Richard Rossi will conduct, and that concert starts at 4 o'clock. Sunday. And Richard's on the phone with me now here on Live and Local. You've got three faculty soloists featured in the first half. You want to talk about those folks?
Yeah, the first half. Should we mention, too, that the Youth Orchestra will be in that first half with you?
You certainly should mention that,
That's
but
right.
We'll get to that second. We'll get to that next.
About that, having all of you come on Saturday to spend the day with our faculty, and all the students going to be work with the faculty individually. And then the Youth Orchestra will be performing the first half of the program at 4 o'clock on Sunday, and then I'll let you probably tell a little bit more about your program. And then after the intermission, then we're going to feature several of our very talented faculty. First, our concertmaster, Anna Crumwell, is going to perform the second movement of the Violin Concerto, number 4 in D major, by Mozart. And then Rebecca Johnson, our flutist, is going to play the Howard Hanson Serenade, followed by the concertino in E-flat for clarinet with Maggie Smith, our clarinet professor. And so it's going to be a wonderful program. I wanted to feature faculty for several reasons. One, I like for them to be up in front of the orchestra and have that exposure. But number two, I thought, especially in light of them working with your students the day before, I thought it would also be important for them to experience seeing the professional artists on stage as soloists with the orchestra as well.
Yeah, the Youth Orchestra came down there last year for the first time doing this an all-day retreat, which they'll do on Saturday, and working with these same faculty members. The flutes, of course, got with Rebecca Johnson, clarinetist with Maggie Smith, and our first violin section with Anna Crumwell. And I think Rebecca and Maggie both played some solo pieces, sort of in a mini recital of sorts for the kids last year, too.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They did do that. Yeah, they did.
So it'd be great to hear them in front of the whole orchestra on that concert. I'm very glad you made the invitation. The East Central Illinois Youth Orchestra enjoys collaborating with professional and other youth orchestras whenever they can. I'm the conductor of that group, and It's a lot of fun to see them interact. So we're the first half of the program, huh?
Yes, you start the program.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, and then there'll be a brief intermission because we need to move the piano up. I didn't want to have the piano in your way as well.
Right.
And it just worked out as far as stage situation and the flow of everything.
Sure.
Least amount of hassle on stage, and I thought it was also great for your kids to get out there, play first, for everyone to see them, and then they can relax and not be nervous anymore, and then listen to the faculty in a relaxed atmosphere.
Yeah, well, it's I think we've got a good program for that first half. We're mm-hmm. we're happy to hog that. We've got, what are we playing? We're playing one of the dances from Smetana's opera, The Bartered Bride. The Shostakovich Festival Overture, which is a lot of fun, and a classical piece post-classical piece in the form of Beethoven's First Symphony, the opening movement from there, which they're doing quite well on, and then a piece that is inspired by older music, but by a 20th century composer, was Ottorino Respighi. He did a bunch of ancient airs and dances, suites, and so we're doing one of the movements from one of those suites. It's just something rather different for them to be working on. And and you guys have a great hall there too. It sounds terrific for orchestra.
Oh yeah, I love this hall. And it's, you know, because I just did my recital Friday, and it's just, you know, the organ sounds fabulous in there, and piano, and then Anna Cromwell played, we did the Prokofiev Violin Sonata, and she was fabulous. And it's just nice. What I love about the concert hall at Eastern, both the audience and the performer can appreciate the warmth of the room. You know, sometimes you get these great halls where you're on stage and everyone says you sound great in the audience, but, you know, as a performer, sometimes it feels like it's just sort of falling at your feet, not realizing it really is swooped up in the hall. But the nice thing about, maybe it's the copper as well, but, you know, the room I thought sounded great even before renovation, and it's only exceptionally better now with the copper, that I think you can appreciate the aesthetic on stage as a performer, which really helps the performer themselves be able to make and nuance the music accordingly, knowing what's coming out to the audience.
It's all visually striking for the audience.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful.
You don't normally see copper-clad stages.
Yeah, and I don't know if you saw the recital hall. I think you did. That's also very beautiful, and the whole back is like a tinted green glass.
And then there's different kinds of metal in there too, isn't there?
Yeah, well,
metal
yeah,
and glass.
There's metal. There's the beams that have metal, but most of it has glass, the backing glass that is supported by iron. But most of the reflective sound is from that glass that surrounds the whole stage.
Yeah, it's a super live sounding space. So anybody who hasn't been to the Doudna Fine Arts Center and the halls there, it's definitely worth checking out. It's a nice facility you have. Let's hear a little bit of what I think is the least often heard piece on your program, a little bit of Howard Hanson's Serenade for Flute, Harp, and Strings, which Rebecca Johnson's going to be featured on in the flute role. Here in this recording is flutist Judith Mendenhall and harpist Susan Jollis, along with the Seattle Symphony led by Gerard Schwartz, music by Howard Hanson, here on Live and Local. We heard a little bit of Howard Hanson's Serenade for Flute, Harp, and Strings here on Live and Local. Rebecca Johnson will be featured flute soloist in a performance with the Eastern Symphony Orchestra in Charleston on Sunday at 4 o'clock at the Doudna Fine Arts Center. Conductor will be Richard Rossi, and that's one of four different works featuring soloists on that concert, three of them with faculty soloists, one with a student soloist, plus the East Central Illinois Youth Orchestra as guest performers in the first half of the show. Richard's on the phone with me right now. Richard, just wanted to ask you a question personally about your involvement down there. I know you said you're about to go on sabbatical next semester, and it sounds like you deserve it. You just gave a recital of your own along with, was it with Anna Cromwell?
Right, with Anna Cromwell. Yeah, we did. Well, I opened the program, you know, with organ playing Bach, Prelude and Fugue in C minor. And then I went to the piano and played the Cacciatorian Toccata and then the Beethoven Pathetique Sonata. And then Anna and I ended with the violin sonata by Prokofiev, originally written for flute, but, you know, the violinist took it over. So yeah. It was a fun program. We had a great time, and playing with Anna is just a dream.
So you do the orchestra there, and you do some solo playing and chamber thing. And then you
do not all the choirs, because I have my colleague Janet McCumber, who also does the mixed chorus. And then I do the concert choir, and then the early music ensemble Camerata, and then I do the Eastern Symphony Orchestra, and then the chamber orchestra, and teach graduate conducting and organ.
Yeah. So how exactly do you juggle all that stuff? And is this your first sabbatical in your 10 or so years there?
Yeah, it is my first sabbatical. Well, I felt I needed to get my doctorate. So I finally got that a couple of years ago, and I thought, you know, I think it's time for sabbatical. And it's sort of good timing because I have some plans. I'm going to be down in Florida. I got a nice condo on the beach so that I could write and practice. I'm already preparing another recital. I want to do the Debussy Pearl of Piano next year. I want to get a concerto ready for a couple of years from now. I'm just thinking about some things for the future. But I have a new publisher also in Indianapolis called La Voce, and I just had four works just published about 2 months ago. And they want me to orchestrate one of them, the one I wrote for the building here when we opened up 2 years ago, Of Beauty. It's a sort of a larger work. It's about eight, 9 minutes. And I'd like to write the orchestration, and I think they're interested in publishing it. So, and I just did it at a festival on Saturday, matter of fact, over near St. Louis. And they loved it. It went over really well, 174 great high school singers, and they did a beautiful job on it. So I was really happy to hear another group outside of Eastern do it. So, yeah, I have plenty. I'm ready for sabbatical.
But it sounds like you're going to do what academic people are supposed to do, which is do some work.
Yeah, some research, and absolutely, but mostly composing and practicing.
And some relaxing.
Yeah, of course, some relaxing, absolutely.
Down in Florida. Well, it's great to talk to you, and it sounds like a great program on Sunday. It's 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon at the Dowdna Fine Arts Center Eastern Symphony Orchestra with various soloists and guests with the East Central Illinois Youth Orchestra. For more information, you can go to eiu.edu/Dowdna and check out all of their events there in addition to this as well. And best of luck with Sunday afternoon's concert.
Thank you, and I look forward to working with you since your kids will be there and you'll be performing as well. So it'll be fun.
It'll be a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's the first of three dances from The Bartered Bride, an opera by Bedřich Smetana, a polka. And that's one of the pieces that the East Central Illinois Youth Orchestra will play on that Eastern Illinois University Orchestra concert on Sunday at 4 o'clock in Charleston. Our broadcast today on Live and Local is made possible in part by the Illinois Symphony Orchestra in Fiery Fun, an evening of Latin American and dance music with guitarist Jason Vio and bandoneonist Lydia Kaminska, Friday, November 12th at Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts in Bloomington, and Saturday, November 13th at Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield. Information is at ilsymphony.org. And Jason Vio and Lydia Kaminska will both join us on Live and Local on Friday's show during the noon hour. Stay tuned for a conversation about John Philip Sousa. My guest on this portion of Live and Local is Patrick Warfield, who is called one of the country's leading Sousa scholars. He's also assistant professor of music at the University of Maryland. And he is going to be on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana Sunday to give a special guest lecture as a guest of the Center for American Music at the University of Illinois and the Sousa Archives. This is American Music Month, and it's entitled Sousa and His League of Players, America's Music in the Golden Age of Baseball. I should say that's the title of the month for the Sousa Archives. And there's a series of concerts, lectures, masterclasses, exhibitions. We'll be actually talking about baseball music on tomorrow's Live and Local. But Professor Warfield is going to be talking Sunday about the essence of Uncle Sam. He calls it John Philip Sousa's 1911 World Tour. And that's it. There's a luncheon at 12 noon at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on the U of I campus Sunday, and then his lecture begins at 1 o'clock, and then there's going to be a concert by the U of I bands at 3 o'clock. So that's all kind of connected together. And Professor Warfield's on the phone with me right now. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that was a bit of a long-winded introduction, but we needed to get through it all to understand why you're even going to be here. I have two initial questions for you. How did you get to be, as Scott Schwartz, the host here, has called you, one of the country's leading Sousa scholars, and why did you want to?
That's an interesting question. Well, when I first went to graduate school, I knew I was interested in wind band music, and that goes back, I suppose, as many people had the experience of having to pick an instrument in fifth or sixth grade, and I chose the clarinet because I knew that would let me sit next to pretty girls in band.
Why didn't you pick a flute then?
Yeah, that probably would have been even smarter, huh? Mm. But over time, I decided to go to college as a musician and ended up in a PhD program in musicology and was still interested in wind band music. But the amount of scholarship out there, I thought I would do 20th century wind band music, but the amount of scholarship was pretty low. And so I thought, well, I better pick a big player, a big figure, a little earlier, a late 19th century person, and Sousa seemed like the obvious choice.
So as a clarinetist, you probably had a lot more interesting parts to play than I did as a horn player.
Yeah, we always joke that the horn players, you don't really need the parts. You just give them the key and tell them to play offbeats. They're okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I once played in an honors band that was led by a guy named Leonard B. Smith. Do you know who he was?
Yes.
The program was nothing but marches, and as a horn player, I got to do or da 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 da. That was about it.
You're going to learn a lot of marches, though. Well, Smith is fantastic because he's one of the fairly few people who conducts Sousa or conducted Sousa in a kind of Sousa style, something that's largely lost. But Leonard B. Smith knew it well and did it well.
So when you said that there was limited scholarship money available, meaning that it was limited unless you picked a big player?
No, I just mean the amount of published scholarship was fairly limited.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Within wind bands.
I see what you mean.
Yeah, and so starting with a piece or a composer active in, say, the 1980s would have left a lot undone.
So then what was your path to becoming such an esteemed scholar?
Well, it turned out that Sousa was much more more interesting than I think almost anybody thought at first. You know, we think of Sousa mostly as a march composer, but in fact he was doing a lot more. In addition to the 130 or so marches, There are suites and descriptive pieces and songs and operettas and three novels and several instruction books. And the other thing that really got me about Sousa is that he stands right on this juncture between 19th century American musical life and 20th century American musical life, a time when Americans are thinking about what art means and how highbrow or lowbrow we wanted to be as a country, and Sousa sort of straddled that moment.
Did he, when you say he did other things besides write marches, what were some of those other things?
Well, at this weekend's event, we're going to be looking at Sousa's 1911, really, world tour. And one of the pieces he wrote for that, and this is a kind of politically incorrect today, but you can see how it might have been interesting to people in 1911, he wrote a suite called Dwellers of the Western World. And each movement is about a different ethnic group that lived in the United States. So there's a section on Native Americans and a section on European immigrants and a section on African American music. And it was actually those sorts of pieces that were sort of the center parts of Sousa concerts, these larger descriptive works, suites, arrangements from operettas, things like that. And then marches kind of filled in the gaps.
Did the non-march music tend to still sound like marches?
It's often a bit marchy, yeah. Some people compare Sousa to sort of a Gilbert and Sullivan-style composer. A lot of it's in that vein. It's light. Although there are several fairly chromatic pieces. Sousa's favorite composer was Richard Wagner, which surprises a lot of people. And there are several works like he wrote pieces whose titles would have been known to his listeners. So things like The Last Days of Pompeii or Sheridan's Ride, and these are often very Wagnerian in their dissonances.
In their dissonances and in their... The breadth of scope, with you know the.
Oh well, he doesn't get ever as long-winded as Wagner, thank goodness.
Well, I meant sort of the big romantic sound.
Yeah, this sort of dramatic shape. But that's true in the marches as well. The marches are more dramatic than we often think of as marches.
What was Sousa's role in the country, just as a, sort of as a celebrity or as an icon?
Yeah, well, there's really two different people, I suppose. There's John Philip Sousa, and then there's this character he played, the March King. And when Sousa was hitting his height, he formed his private band in 1892 and played at the Chicago World's Fair the following year. And by the mid-1890s, he was a pretty significant figure in American culture. But he was a figure who worked very hard to put Americans at ease. You know, this is a time when we're trading agrarian lives for city lives. People have much more leisure activity, a little bit more disposable income. And there was some fear about that, some fear that as we stopped working on the farms, we'd get fat and soft and intellectually weak. And Sousa was that virile musician. He wasn't the Liszts or the Paganinis. He wasn't the virtuoso. He wasn't showy. He talks about, you know, having no use for musicians who smell of Dutch cheese, but wanting to be strong and virile, and his music is certainly that.
What does Dutch cheese smell like?
I don't really know.
I thought you were gonna say, you know, smelling like perfume, thinking of the Liszts and Paganinis and
so on. In fact, he sounds a lot like Charles Ives in that sense. There's some the masculine quality to it.
The manly March King.
Exactly.
In this case.
Yeah.
You told me yesterday when we just talked briefly that among the things your lecture on Sunday is going to cover is a bit about march form, and you were going to use two particular marches, one of which we played leading into this conversation, Sousa's most famous one, which is the Stars and Stripes Forever, mm-hmm. and then one called the Federal. Can you give us sort of an outline of what's going to happen in that discussion?
Sure, well, I can give you the kind of quick and dirty. Sousa didn't invent the march, and of course there were thousands of pieces that were sort of designed to move troops around written in the 19th century. But almost all of them were circular pieces. They all ended with a thing called a da capo, go back to the beginning. And usually in classical music, when you see a da capo, you expect somewhere in there to be a fine, an end. But marches didn't have that. They just said da capo, go back to the beginning, and play it again, and play it again, and play it again, and play it again. And this made a lot of sense. If you were moving troops down a parade route, You didn't know how long it was going to be. You needed a piece that could go on forever, if necessary. And Sousa talks about how that wasn't the kind of piece he wanted to write. He has a, I'm not going to get this quite right, but he said it's as though you served a meal, and you serve the ice cream, and then at the end of the ice cream, you go back to the roast beef, but the roast beef has no new sauce on it, no new flavor. It was the circular kind of piece. But when you listen to a piece like The Stars and Stripes Forever, you'll notice that all of it sort of gets pushed to the end, to the section we call the trio. And so you first hear that wonderful little melody all by itself, and then it gets repeated, but this time it's that wonderful melody with the piccolos on top. And then a third time you hear it, now there's this big grand trombone counter melody. And so the whole piece gets layer after layer. It's this dramatic shape. And there's a reason for that. The Sousa Band existed between 1892 and Sousa's death in 1932, so about 40 years. And over that period, they gave more than 15,000 concerts. That's more than a concert per day.
Yeah, it's a lot of concerts.
That's a lot of concerts. But they only marched 8 times.
Hmm.
And so Sousa marches aren't really for marching. They're for sitting and listening to, and they have that dramatic shape that makes them interesting for listening. Sort of the way Wagner has a dramatic shape, or The Last Days of Pompeii, you would imagine, have a dramatic shape.
And so the Federal is one that I'm actually not familiar with.
Yeah, it's not a very well-known march today. Sousa wrote about 130 marches, not all of which are marches like we think of them. There are some funeral marches and some medley marches and things like that. But about 130 marches, and really just a handful of them are well-known today. The Stars and Stripes Forever, the Liberty Bell, Hands Across the Sea, the Washington Post. And so there are a lot of them that have sort of gotten buried. And that's true of any popular musician. You know, you can think of a group like the Beatles had lots and lots of recordings, many of which were quite successful in the 1960s. But unless you're a Beatles aficionado, you probably remember a dozen of them or so. And that's true with Sousa. There's just this handful. The Federal was actually written in 1910 for the World Tour. It's dedicated to the people of Australia and New Zealand, and the sheet music has a little advertisement on it as played by Sousa's band on his World Tour. And so this whole thing was part of an advertising strategy. Sousa was both a conductor of a band and a publisher of sheet music, and he wanted to make money on both ends. And so the more you could tie a piece to its own performance, that way people would buy the sheet music and want to hear the band, or people could go to a concert and want to buy the sheet music, and so you'd go back and forth.
And make some money.
And make some money, exactly. And Sousa made an enormous amount of money.
Well, giving that many concerts, I certainly hope so, because
yeah.
His arms are going to be really sore, and he would have earned his keep. Well, let's give a listen. Here's John Philip Sousa's The Federal. We're talking with Patrick Warfield, who's going to be giving a talk on Sunday in Urbana on the University of Illinois campus called The Essence of Uncle Sam, John Philip Sousa's 1911 World Tour. And you're listening to Live and Local. March called The Federal here on Live and Local by John Philip Sousa. And you can hear a little bit about the form of that piece and of Stars and Stripes Forever and a lot about the March King himself if you attend Sunday afternoon's lecture at 1 o'clock at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. The guest lecture is going to be given by Patrick Warfield, who is a professor at the University of Maryland and a leading Sousa scholar. And he's on the phone with me now on the show. The initial part of the title of your lecture, The Essence of Uncle Sam, what is that about?
Well, this is the part that got me interested in the World Tour. The Sousa Band had traveled all across America, those 15,000 concerts that took them from New York to San Francisco and from Montreal to New Orleans. And then starting about right at the very beginning of the 20th century, they made a series of European tours, mostly the UK, but then they headed across Europe. They even played in Russia. But it wasn't until the end of 1910 that they set sail for this world tour, which, you know, in our sense of the world, it wasn't quite a world tour, but it was pretty good for 1911. They hit the UK. They played in South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Hawaii, so more than the world than they had. But in every case, they were playing to countries that had large European populations. So Sousa's audience was white for the most part, English-speaking people who knew his music already. He wasn't playing to native Africans or native Australians on this tour. And what you see in the reviews are this sort of fascination with what it means to be American. Sousa was seen as a typical American in that he was quick, and there was promptitude, and there was hustle, and his concerts sped along with this huge variety of music. You even can find some reviews where people try to write in an Americanized dialect about what a fine young man that John Philip Sousa is on the podium. And at the very end of this tour, one critic wrote that now they've heard Sousa, they want to see America. He had become the essence of Uncle Sam.
How did the music compare, or how did the music strike these audiences? Was it that much different than what they were used to hearing?
Not enormously. At the start of the century, world citizens didn't know an enormous amount about America. We weren't a big world power. But certainly American music had started to seep elsewhere. Ragtime was of great interest around the world. But the music that Sousa played, if you look at a Sousa program, it's not unfamiliar music. It would be a Wagner overture, maybe a Rossini overture or a Verdi overture, so European classical music, interspersed with lighter novelty sorts of numbers, so maybe a cornet solo or a trombone feature. And if you just looked at the program, it would look pretty short with just these handful of kind of varied pieces. But every single work on the program was encored, and those encores were usually the Sousa marches.
Mm.
And Sousa marches were extraordinarily well known really all across the world through publications, their sheet music publications. In fact, there's one review where the critic says something like, Sousa marches have been done to death by German bands and barrel organs. They've been hashed up on records. He's heard them over and over again, and he wasn't sure he wanted to hear them again. But then when Sousa started playing and he heard this new performance practice, this new way of playing them, he was excited. There's a vim about a Sousa march is played by the Sousa band.
Hmm.
So it wasn't that the pieces were new, but you finally got to hear the performer play them.
Did they talk about what they found different?
The reviewers usually aren't able to quite articulate this, but we know what it was. A Sousa march, as printed, it looks like a very boring piece of music. It's a lot of repetition. And you know, anybody who sat through too many band concerts knows that they can get a little pedestrian over time. But what Sousa would do is wave out his trumpets and wave out his cornets and wave out his trombones the first time through a strain. And so he'd get this very delicate sound where you could hear all those horn parts, those inner voices. He even had a harp player. You could hear all of that going on. And then the second time he played the same material, it would be loud and bombastic. So you got this dramatic shape, and audiences loved that because they didn't ever hear it if they were just playing the sheet music.
So when you say wave out, you mean he would just have them not play for
Exactly. He would drop out those instruments.
Yeah, which, of course, that's all the performance practice thing.
Yes.
I mean, it's even like, I suppose, you can, if you play in a band now and you play with a bunch of guest conductors, certain conductors come through and the march will still sound pedestrian, and some
yes.
unspeakable, you know, essence of, say, Frederick Fennell, who was one of our finest band conductors, mm-hmm. would come in and turn the march into something thrilling. I mean, I experienced him a few times and had exactly that impression. I was never
yeah.
quite sure what he was doing, but it sure made it sound different and a lot more fun.
Right, and the other thing to remember is that, again, Sousa marches weren't actually used for marching, so they weren't these rigid left-right sorts of sounds, but they were used for dancing. The Washington Post became known as the music for the two-step.
Really?
So they were light and delicate and flavorful, and Sousa played them that way.
I'm trying to picture anybody dancing to the Stars and Stripes.
Yeah, well, probably maybe not the Stars and Stripes, but you do see it to the Washington Post, certainly.
Huh. You said that there are, you know, in the German bands and so on. How common was the, you know, I guess the military band in Sousa's form? How common was that throughout the regions that he toured?
Well, certainly almost everybody had a military band, and lots of countries, the United States had them. Several countries had even bigger, more impressive ones. In fact, when the Sousa Band was formed in 1892, one of the goals was to make it as good as the great military bands of France. There was this effort to recruit the very best players at the very best salaries. So certainly, almost everywhere he went, especially these colonial areas, had bands in the English style.
And were they... Now you said the English style.
Well, that's going to be mostly brass bands, although certainly not exclusively at the beginning of the 20th century.
As opposed to Sousa's group, which has lots of woodwinds. And...
Right, yes. Sousa is known as a band that had lots of clarinets, which makes it a little more delicate than a band with lots of cornets or trumpets.
So that is one of the distinguishing factors
when
he toured them. Well, that would make a huge difference.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the description of your talk on Sunday, and you talk about his sort of bringing to his tour his musical portrayal of American commercial, aesthetic, and artistic life. How did those aspects show up by his playing the music?
Yeah, this goes back to the sort of speed and hustle. Sousa played a trick on his audiences because, again, this period when we're a little uncertain about our masculinity, our strength as a country and as a people, the change from agrarian to industrial life. And Sousa made this real effort not to appear to be a celebrity, but to appear to be a regular person on the podium. And one of the tricks he did for this were those march encores. If you saw the program, Sousa looked very humble. The only pieces on that with his name next to it were a suite and maybe his new march advertised as new. But what would happen is the audience would call for all of these encores. And so Sousa's music, which is what they wanted, was everywhere. But his name wasn't advertised everywhere. But this was a trick. The marches happened very quickly. They happened too fast to not have been pre-planned. And this is what critics noted, that the whole concert moved with this incredible haste, this incredible speed. It was very what most of the world thought of as typical of America. We were a hustling people.
Well, you can get a much more lengthy description or answers to all these questions that I've posed, which is all we can get in about 20 minutes, if you go hear Patrick Warfield on Sunday. There's a luncheon at 12 o'clock, followed by his lecture at 1 o'clock, and then a concert by the University of Illinois Harding and Hinesley Symphonic Bands. Their program is called Rounding the Bases, Circling the Globe, Sousa's World Tour, and Baseball. That's going to be at 3 o'clock at the Krannert Center in Urbana, and the luncheon and lecture are at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center, also on the campus. And Patrick Warfield's lecture called The Essence of Uncle Sam, John Philip Sousa's 1911 World Tour. It's part of the U of I Center for American Music Month celebrations. And we're very pleased to have had Professor Warfield on the phone with us. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And we'll go out with another Sousa march. This is one that I learned in that concert that I played with Leonard B. Smith, and in spite of playing nothing but da-da-da-da-da-da-da on the horn, I actually kind of fell in love with this one. It's called The Black Horse Troop on Live and Local. I love that march. It's the Black Horse Troop of John Philip Sousa. Frederick Fennell leading the Eastman Wind Ensemble here on Live and Local. Time for our events calendar. Wanted to be sure to get that in today. And tonight at the Iron Post at 5 o'clock, it's the Woody Woodward Organ Trio downtown Urbana. Also at the Iron Post at 8 o'clock, the Mean Lids performing. There's live Irish music, the weekly traditional music session at Bentley's Pub in downtown Champaign. That's at 7 o'clock. The Freak Brothers with John Elder are at the Independent Media Center in Urbana tonight at 7:30. And the University of Illinois Opera Program presents Rigoletto starting tomorrow. And in fact, we'll be having a conversation with Henson Keys, the director of that production, on tomorrow's Live and Local. So it's tomorrow, Friday, Saturday at 7:30, and then a Sunday matinee. At the Eastern Illinois University, the Wind Symphony there is playing a program called A Call to Duty, a Veterans Day tribute. That's tomorrow at 7:30 in the Dvorak Concert Hall at Downey Fine Arts Center in Charleston. At the Hoagland Center for the Arts in Springfield, it's the musical Altar Boys throughout the weekend, starting tomorrow at 8 o'clock. And also a show called Dear Edwina Jr. is at the Hoagland Center starting on Friday. That's at 7 o'clock. And Friday night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center, it's the Baseball Music Project. That's at 7:30 Friday, and we're going to be having a conversation on tomorrow's Live and Local with their conductor. At the Kirkland Fine Arts Center on the Millikan University campus in Decatur, Friday at 7:30, it's the musical The Drowsy Chaperone. And at Northridge Middle School in Danville, they begin their productions of Cinderella Friday night at 7:30. Those are just some of the things you can go out and see and hear in our area. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WYL-FM and HD1 and HD2 Urbana, with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville. WYL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. And we have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from noon to 4 in the Bouvant's Tasting Room. More information is at thecorkscrew.com. We'll have a mostly sunny afternoon with a high temperature around 72 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy, the low around 45. Tomorrow, partly sunny, but the high again around 72. And Friday, mostly sunny, the high 72. Currently 70 degrees.